are Amy and Christina, two moms who learned the hard way that there's a lot we wish we knew about pregnancy and parenting.
So now we're asking experts all the questions, sharing what we've learned and what we're still figuring out, and keeping it real along the way. Welcome to What I Wish I Knew.
Today's episode left us feeling all kinds of fired up. We spoke with Dr. Mona Orati, a gynecologic surgeon, founder of the Orati Women's Clinic in San Francisco, a mom of two, and a fierce advocate for improving women's health. She's traveling the world giving lectures, performing literally life-changing surgeries, breastfeeding in between all of that, and still graciously agreed to speak with us on a weekend, no less.
We came in thinking we understood conditions like fibroids and endometriosis and left realizing how many women are misdiagnosed, dismissed, or just quietly suffering. Dr. Orati is working hard to change that, and we're so grateful she shared her time and her brilliance with us. If you've ever been told, it's just part of being a woman, you need this episode. Let's get into it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We really, like, honestly, I want to be very respectful of your time, so I want to make sure that we just kind of, like, dive in, and so that you can go do, you know, something that you want to do for you.
Whatever that might be.
So how did you end up becoming or like deciding to be a gynecologist, not a gynecologist, a gynecologic surgeon?
I am a minimally invasive gynecologic surgeon.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a mouthful.
It's called MIGS for short. MIGS. MIGS. Yeah.
So yeah. How did you end up in MIGS? What kind of like triggered this interest?
I think I've always had the interest. When I was in medical school, I knew I was going to do gynecology. So, I mean, just to go back, I always knew I was going to be a doctor. When I was four, I was the one with the little, you know, doctor kit and, you know, the little stethoscope. And my poor twin brother was always the patient. He was always getting, you know, fake shots and fake operations and, you know, bandaged up. And, you know, that I knew I was going to be a doctor. I knew I was going to take care of people and help healing. Like the whole concept of healing was amazing to me. I was like the one kid that loved to go to the pediatrician because I just loved watching what they do. And, you know,
and not because of the suckers that they give you. We always got suckers when we went to the pediatrician. Yeah, that's why I like to go.
No, it wasn't the stickers and the suckers. It was more just the concept of healing and you know, taking care of people. It was always something that I was drawn to for as long as I can remember. My mom says when I was four, like I was dead set that I was going to be like a doctor or surgeon kind of thing. And then when I was nine, I knew I was going to be a gynecologist. My mom would take me to her. She was a professional woman. She'd take me to her professional women's groups. And everyone would always be complaining about something female related and how they were unheard and, you know, how they had this problem or that problem. They go to the doctor and nobody was helping them. And they try to like help each other or try this herbal thing, try that thing, you know? And I was like, okay, well, women really need help. And if I'm going to heal people, like who better to heal than women, especially, you know, as I'm growing up as a Muslim woman and a minority, I felt like Muslim women and minorities especially were very isolated and just were not taken care of. So I became very passionate about that. So when I was nine, I'm like, I'm going to be a women's health doctor. I'm going to take care of women. And, you know, and then I was like, what the hell am I spending all this time in school for? Let's just get going. And so I accelerated my studies and I actually went to college when I was 12. And then I started med school at 17. And then when I was in medical...
Wait, hold on. Can we just have a moment for that?
I was about to say, what like
this... on earth? Am I speaking to the smartest human that I've ever encountered personally in my life? Possibly.
Not. Just someone possibly. Really driven, I think. Yeah. Wow. And I mean, like, I was very serious about it. I remember when I was like 9, 10 years old, I would like, at you know how we would pray before we go to bed? And my prayer every night when I was like 10 years old was that God would make me a healer for women and one of the best surgeons in the world. Like that was my one prayer. Like, you know, a 9 year old would, you know, I don't know what 9 year olds pray for, but that was what my prayer was every night, you know, that God would make me like the best surgeon, the best healer for women. Like that was like really my goal.
Wow.
I was ultra focused. And so, you know, like I was just like, I had this mission and I wanted to get there. And when I started medical school, immediately I gravitated to my mentor, who was a GYN oncology surgeon. And I would go into surgery with them. Like, I mean, starting first year medical school, I spent my entire first year medical school summer in surgery with this amazing surgeon. His name was Dr. Akira Sugimoto. And I just thought that when you do surgery well, it was the most beautiful thing ever. It was like you could take me to a ballet or a symphony, and then it was just as beautiful for me. And I wanted to become that. I wanted to become an amazing surgeon. You know, so I really gravitated towards gynecology and the surgery side of it when I was in medical school. Obviously, in residency, I had to do the OB side as well, which I love that too. It's just when push came to shove and I finished and I graduated and I became fascinated by minimally invasive surgery as minimally invasive surgery was starting to come to the forefront. And robotic surgery was just starting, you know, 2005 was when I finished my residency. That's right when the robot kind of got FDA approved and was starting to become a thing. I immediately gravitated towards that because I was like, you know, how big a difference can I make for a woman if I don't have to do an open incision and slice her open to do surgery and be able to do an entire complicated surgery with the robot? And I saw the potential of it. And it was just, you know, there, some of it is innate, but some of it is that I really wanted to help these patients. Because I was at that point, I was at Henry Ford Hospital in inner city Detroit. And a lot of the women were single moms, you know, very poor income patients. And if they had to have an abdominal hysterectomy or an abdominal myomectomy, get open and get 6 or 8 weeks off of work, and they would lose their job, they would lose their income, they wouldn't be able to take care of their kids. And literally, if you couldn't offer them something else, they would either have to live in pain or bleeding or whatever, and just ignore their health problems, or else they would lose their job and lose their kids. And I mean, it was a huge thing. So when I started doing robotic surgery, I started offering them, okay, well, let me try to do your surgery robotic. It is a very complicated surgery, but I see the potential of this device. And I see that you can do almost anything you can do open with it. And I kept telling them, I'll just try my best. And then 50-50, I'll have to open you anyway, but at least we tried and, you know, then we'll figure it out. And honestly, I kept saying that for like the first 500 cases. And I never had to open anyone. I was able to accomplish all of those cases robotically without, and gave those patients back their life and back to normal activities within, you know, a couple of, you know, a week or two, and, you know, minimal blood loss, minimal complications. I mean, I just saw the impact of that.
I was just going to ask to clarify. I don't think I actually know. Like, I mean, I get the idea of what minimally invasive means, but what are you actually doing?
So basically what minimally invasive surgery is, the traditional way of doing surgery, for example, a hysterectomy would be to actually cut the abdomen, right? Make an incision on the abdomen, open up the abdomen, go in with your hands, put clamps on and, you know, remove whatever it is you need to remove with this big open incision. And then you close the incision and then you'd end up with, you know, an incision yay long, you know, about, you know, 10, 12 centimeters long, that now has to heal and is, you know, causes a lot of pain and discomfort and has high complications and wound infections, hernias and things like that. Where minimally invasive surgery is where you do the same surgery, but you're using a camera that goes into the abdomen to be able to visualize the interior. And then you place instruments through the abdominal wall into the abdomen. And then you do the surgery basically on the inside. And I actually think because you have that camera, which is usually magnified, high definition, for now they're like 4K, like it's just, you know, the technology is progressed so much, you can actually see better. And as an endometriosis surgeon, you can actually see that almost everyone that has fibroids, for example, they also have endometriosis. So we've learned over the years that if you have fibroids, fibroids don't cause pain, although they end up getting blamed for the pain, whereas they actually have endometriosis, which causes pain. And it's interesting that some patients will like go have a hysterectomy and they still have endometriosis in there. So they'll still have pain and they think, oh, well, I had this hysterectomy. Why am I still having pain? And then they get blown off and things like that. So that's why I actually basically, you know, since 2005 to now, so 2025 to the last 20 years, I've spent that time really advancing the field, traveling the world, sharing my knowledge, sharing my techniques that I've developed, like just trying to get advancement in women's health, in the understanding of pelvic pain, abnormal bleeding, you know, menstrual disorders. So that's kind of where I had to make a decision at some point. And the decision happened around 2008, 2009, when I was at Henry Ford Hospital. I had to make a decision that, you know, I either have to do gynecology or OB. And my passion had always been surgery and gynecology. So it was a very easy decision for me. And then after that, you know, a Cleveland Clinic called me and asked me to come there and become their director of robotic surgery education at their Women's Health Center, Center for Fibroids and Endometriosis. So it was a great opportunity for me to enter, you know, an advanced, you know, gynecology focused practice. And then in 2016, I left Cleveland Clinic and I came here to San Francisco for family reasons. I had to move to California because my father was ill and things like that. And so I came here and I said, well, I can do the same thing I did at Cleveland Clinic here. And I've been gradually working towards that. Finally, like almost 2 years ago now, I've opened the Aradi Women's Clinic where I'm going to try to do the same thing. I really want a place where there's advanced gynecology, where women who have questions, who don't have answers, go. Because the problem is with education, most OBGYN residency programs do not focus on GYN at all. And menstrual disorders is even less than that. Endometriosis, even less than that. You know, they spend 80% of their time learning OB and like 20% in gynecology. Less that, I mean, you get so little training that most gynecologists, when they graduate residency or when they finish their residency, don't know what endometriosis surgery is. Some people don't even know that it exists. So there's just a lot of misinformation out there. And unless a gynecologist has really taken it upon themselves to focus and learn and educate themselves and advance at, like I did over the last 20 years, you know, I can't blame them. They don't have that knowledge. And luckily now with social media, women are starting to talk amongst themselves and learn that, you know, that although there's a lot of myths out there, there's a lot of things that is just, there's a lot of misinformation.
And there sure is.
And that's why, you know, I speak a lot. I do a lot of podcasts. I do a lot of lectures for doctors, non-doctors. I didn't really do any kind of fellowship or anything to learn this. It was all through my own endeavor to kind of push that passion that I really wanted to help women. I just don't think that women should have hysterectomies unless they really need to, unless there's a reason for it. And I don't think having pain or bleeding is necessarily a reason, because you have to find out what the cause is. And that was what my focus was. It's like, I don't understand why we're just treating symptoms. It's like a Band-Aid. Rather than find out what the cause of the symptom is and treat the root cause. And that's why I think you guys asked me in the questions why I was called Sherlock Holmes of gynecology. It's because I was the one person that was like, no, I don't just want to know how to treat the disease or whatever it is the symptoms patients are having. I want to know what's causing it. And that's where I spent a lot of my time, is trying to figure out what the causes are and trying to get to the root cause of the problems and treating it at the root. Because to me, if you Band-Aid it, it's just going to come back.
Right.
And the two Band-Aids are they both suck, really. I mean, hysterectomy is terrible. And then birth control pills, you know, 50% of women don't even tolerate birth control pills. They make them depressed. They make them moody. They make them have low libido. There's a ton of side effects from birth control pills, you know, and I'm not saying they don't have their place. There are some conditions that where there's hormonal imbalances or wherever that we need birth control pills. You know, endometriosis is well suppressed with progesterone. So there are places where we can use hormones. I just don't think it should be the reflex first treatment. It's like, well, what's the point? What's this birth control going to do different than this other birth control? You haven't treated the root cause. You're just going to continue to spiral. And then I see patients who come to me and they've like been bleeding for 4 years on birth control pills. It's like, why don't you find out why you're bleeding instead of just trying to Band-Aid you?
Yeah, totally.
And they come to me and they're so fed up and they're so like, they were so hopeless. And they come in and I'm like, you're my only hope. It's like, I feel like Obi-Wan, you're my only hope, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Sherlock Holmes, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
It's like, well, okay, well, let's get to the root cause of this and let's try to fix it.
Totally.
And that was kind of what motivated me to kind of go down that minimally invasive surgery and become a MIGS surgeon and get really involved with education. And I became part of the world team at the Society of Laparoscopic and Robotic Surgeons. We travel the world, we teach all over the world. So it's just, it's just been an amazing experience. I mean, I'm very lucky that I had those opportunities.
The Cleveland Clinic is no joke. I'm from Cleveland, actually. I don't know if I told you that. Yeah. No, but the Cleveland Clinic is, I mean, obviously famous for so many advancements in so many medical fields, but
so it's funny. The reason I called my clinic the Irati Women's Clinic is, first of all, as a legacy, my father, who I did come here to California to take care of, did pass on, but he was all about helping people, and he was like, so I wanted to name it the Irati Women's Clinic, where we can become the Cleveland Clinic here. Like, I really do like what the Cleveland Clinic does. Like, it's a very, it's an amazing institution. And it was amazing to be part of it and to grow there and to, you know, to help them develop. But I'm like, we need something like that here on the West Coast.
I'm surprised it doesn't exist already.
It doesn't really.
That's wild. I wanted to quickly just go back to, because, you know, a lot of our listeners probably don't know what some of these words mean. So, like, can you tell us what are fibroids and then what is endometriosis? Because, you know, again, we are about educating and we need to, I just need to make sure that everybody can start from a base level.
Yeah, very easy. So fibroids and endometriosis are probably the two most common add-on polyps. So three things that are extremely common in women that affects their periods and affect their ability to get pregnant. Fibroids affect about 20% of women. Endometriosis affects about 20% of women. And polyps, almost everyone will get a polyp at some point in their life. It's just, it happens. So let me tell you the difference between the three things. So first of all, let's start with the easy one. A polyp is an overgrowth of the lining of the uterus. It is the most common cause of abnormal bleeding, spotting between periods, often triggered by either, you know, some sort of stress, or they're going through IVF, or they're taking hormones, and they develop these little overgrowths in the uterus. What's interesting about them is they're the most common cause of abnormal bleeding, and yet very, very poorly diagnosed. That poor woman that was bleeding for 4 years, it was literally a polyp. And I do polyp removals in my office in like 5 minutes.
Stop.
So what kills me is that she bled for 4 years when I literally could have fixed it for her in 5 minutes, which I did. And then she never had any abnormal bleeding again. So you go in and you remove the polyp. So that's number one. A fibroid is an overgrowth of the muscle. It's a smooth muscle tumor, a benign tumor of the uterus. So the uterus has three layers: the outer saran wrap layer, which is called peritoneum. It covers the outside of the uterus. The muscle layer, which contracts when we're in labor. And then the endometrium, which is what sheds every month when we have a period. And that's where polyps form. Fibroids form in the muscle. So they're smooth muscle tumors of the uterus. They're very common. A lot of women, by the time they hit menopause, will have a fibroid or two. The problem is it's a tumor. So it grows. And in some people, it grows fast. In some people, it grows slowly. In some people, it's just one. In some people, it's like a million, like 20, 30 fibroids. And again, the misinformation out there is that a lot of women go in with some problem, pain, bleeding, or they just have a mass or whatever. They're told, oh, yeah, you have fibroids. And they're like, oh, okay, what do I do about it? They're like, oh, don't worry about it. The problem is, yes, you do need to worry about it, because if the fibroid grows too big, you can actually destroy your uterus. And then now it's time to get pregnant. And guess what? Now your uterus is not functioning. And so to me, it's it's misinformation when people are told not to worry about it. You do need to follow it and see if it grows or not. And there is a point where you need to intervene and remove the fibroid, because if it gets too big, it can, as I said, destroy the uterus or affect things. And a lot of times, you know, there are fibroids that are causing heavy bleeding or pressing on things. I mean, it can even get so bad that fibroids get so large that they press on your ureters, the tubes that connect to the kidneys, and you lose kidney function. Like, it's just something like that. And then, you know, I see patients and they're like, I'm like, how long did you know you had fibroids? They have these huge fibroids. And they're like, oh, I found out about it, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, but my doctor said not to worry about it. I'm like, well, at what point do we worry about it? You know, so to me, if you have a fibroid as a patient, yes, most of the time, if they're small and they're not in a location that would affect anything, we just follow them and watch them. I usually do yearly ultrasounds on those patients that have fibroids. But at some point, we have to have a discussion. Do we need to remove the fibroid? Do we need to do something about the fibroid? Is it affecting you? Especially if they're not looking at pregnancy now, we don't want it to affect pregnancy later. Or sometimes the fibroids are getting really bad. And I'm like, listen, if you want to have a baby, have it now. Like, let's get pregnant. And, you know, before the fibroids get too bad. So that's what fibroids are. They usually cause pressure or bleeding. They don't usually cause pain, which is a misnomer, because a lot of people go in with pelvic pain, because as I said, painful periods, which is not normal. It's not normal to have painful periods. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But painful period, pain with sex, just pelvic pain in general, a lot of patients get, they blame the fibroid when that's not the cause. Fibroids are associated with endometriosis. Endometriosis affects about 70% of women with fibroids. So what happens is that the fibroid is very easily visible on ultrasound, so they blame the fibroid and they miss the fact that the patient probably also has endometriosis. Now let's talk about endometriosis. Endometriosis is a condition that affects, as I said, about 20% of women. Like fibroids, it is genetically based. So basically, if you have your mom has endometriosis or fibroids, or your sister, you're more likely to have it. A lot of people don't know that their parents or mom or aunt had it because it's not diagnosed, right? Endometriosis is a condition where there's actual abnormal tissue, usually endometrial-like tissue, but not endometrium necessarily, that grows outside of the uterus onto other organs. So it can grow on, usually on peritoneum, but it can actually act like a cancer and start invading like the bowel, the ureters, the ovaries, the appendix. It can affect the diaphragm. So it's an abnormal tissue that spreads outside. And every time you menstruate, that abnormal endometrial like tissue will also bleed and cause internal bleeding. And what? So it causes pain, bloating. A lot of people with IBS have endometriosis. A lot of people with like a small bladder, it's endometriosis on the bladder or inflammation related to endometriosis.
Oh my God.
Pain with sex, pain with periods. A lot of these things are all endometriosis that's just not diagnosed. The classic symptom though, like I think patients usually start with symptoms usually in high school or early college, with these type of symptoms. The main symptom is pain before the period. So 1 or 2 days before the period. You shouldn't be having pain before the period actually starts. If you have pain before the period, you probably have endometriosis. Also, most women don't have significant pain with the period. So significant pain with the period is also not normal. A lot of people think it is.
Do you mean pain like cramping? Like what kind of pain?
Cramping. That's not normal. Cramping. Yeah.
That's so weird because I feel like when we learn about PMS, it's like part of PMS.
Right. So it's one of my pet peeves. Every time I open a period app, it has this whole section on how do you deal with pain with periods, but it doesn't talk about that if you have pain with periods, you probably have endometriosis and you probably need to be treated. And it's not until the patient is in their 30s and now having trouble getting pregnant or having infertility that they now get diagnosed.
Is it hard to diagnose it? Like, why is that? Why is that? That people just aren't having that conversation.
I mean, I'm an endometriosis expert. So for me, it's not hard to diagnose, right? If somebody comes in and says, yeah, I have this pain before the period, I have bloating, I have IBS, I have pain with sex, I pee a lot, I wake up at night to pee, like blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, you have endometriosis, done, you know? But the problem is a lot of times, because gynecologists aren't trained, they can't pick it up on ultrasound and exam. I can because I do this a lot. I've seen 10,000 patients with endometriosis, so I know what it feels like. I know what it looks like on ultrasound. But most of the time, it's just completely like, you know, blown off. Oh, you have painful periods. Oh, that's normal. It's like, really? Who said
right.
so?
Right.
Who said no, that?
Like the entire world, literally.
Oh, you have pain with sex? Oh, just, you know, try to relax more.
Try a different position. Right.
Try a different position. Right. That's not normal. You shouldn't have pain with sex. You shouldn't have pain with your period. You definitely shouldn't have pain before the period. At 20, 23, 24 years old, you should not be waking up at night to pee. IBS is not normal, right? Having bloating, diarrhea, pain around your periods, you know, all of this, that's all not normal. And if you have it, you should at least get diagnosed so that you know you have it. And then we can discuss treatment options, even if the treatment is just, oh, well, let's just watch it for now.
Right. You know, well, that's going to be my next question is like, once someone's diagnosed with endometriosis, what can you do about it?
Yeah. So there's a couple of options depending on, you know, the severity of symptoms, what their childbearing desires are, where they are in their life. You know, you can either treat it with medications, suppress the endometriosis until it's time to surgically remove it, or you can do surgery if the symptoms are severe or someone's having difficulty getting pregnant, because usually you can remove it. So again, another pet peeve of mine, a lot of people, patients come to me after years of quote unquote unexplained infertility. It's most people with unexplained infertility have endometriosis. Almost all of them do. And if you treat the endometriosis, you give them back the chance of having fertility. So it's like, well, why do we just put people through all of these fertility treatments? They might need it. And I don't say not fertility treatments are bad. They are. They are necessary for some people. But for some people, if we just diagnose and treat the problem, they can get pregnant without having to go through all of that angst and those years of treatments that might ultimately fail. And then you still end up with the original problem, which is endometriosis.
Does endometriosis, it prohibits you from getting pregnant? Does it have any, or it makes it harder to get pregnant? Does it have any effect on if you do get pregnant, like a higher chance of miscarriage or something? Yeah, is it just all of it?
Oh. Yeah, it affects your ability to get pregnant and affects the ability for a pregnancy to stick. It declines your egg quality. I mean, it affects all of it. It's a chronic inflammation in the pelvis.
Why aren't we talking about this more?
I know. I just got back from the endometriosis summit 2 weeks ago. We are talking about it. But, you know, you have to, like, women are talking about it. The problem is... We need to talk about it more.
We do.
A lot of women are walking around thinking that having pain with their period or pain with sex or IBS or bladder symptoms, the small bladder thing, that doesn't exist. There's no such thing. Everyone is born with a bladder that is a normal size.
What on earth?
I'm just...
Yeah. My mind is blown right now.
I always laugh when patients tell me, oh, I have a small bladder. I'm like, no, you don't.
No, you don't. That's not how it works.
It's science.
Bladders are made to stretch. You
know? This is first of all blowing my mind, right? But like, because infertility has such like a mental, physical toll, huge. Like even doing fertility treatments that like, it's kind of blowing my mind that endometriosis, it feels so simple. Do you know what I mean? Yes. The problem is it is one of the solutions.
But there isn't enough people out there that know how to treat it.
Right.
Endometriosis.
Or even diagnosis, it sounds like. Diagnose it and treat it.
Right. Let alone treat it. The number of endometriosis surgeons in the country, I mean, they're probably 100 or 200 at the most, like two per state. It's not that many.
That's insane. I mean, that's insane. So we've talked about some of the symptoms around endometriosis, like pain before your period, pain during your period, pain during sex, bloating. Basically, if like anything isn't working the way you think it should, you might have endometriosis at this point. But
yeah, and the studies show that it takes women an average of 8 years to even get diagnosed.
Oh,
and like
my God.
Six gynecologists.
Well, there goes like your childbearing years. Eight years. I mean, a lot of times, I feel like nowadays too, people are waiting longer to have children because they're doing whatever with and their lives. And then
it's getting worse, so it's more likely to affect you. So, I mean, a lot of patients with endometriosis still can get pregnant. It's just, I think once you get older, the endometriosis has gotten worse. I think the patients that get pregnant with endometriosis are usually the ones that try younger and it hasn't quite gotten to the point that it's affecting them severely, which brings me to the whole other point. Their endometriosis average age of onset is 14. So we have a lot of teenagers out there that have endometriosis that are told that their pain is in their head and, you know, oh, suck it up. It's part of being a woman, right? The curse, and these women later on become chronic pain patients that are non-functional. They drop out of school, they don't go to college. You know, in the last year I've treated like three teenagers, one who's 11, one who's 13, and one who's 16, probably six of them, all of which, you know, they were basically told it's all in their head, you know, and they came to me, they've dropped out of school. Two of them were walking with a cane. They couldn't even walk. They were like limping into my office.
Unbelievable.
And they, you know, all they were given was birth control pills, which of course didn't work. And I told them, you need surgery. We just need to do surgery. And now all of these women have their life back. They're back in school. They're playing sports. Like, what would have happened had their moms not insisted on trying to find me? I'm trying to find someone who would give their daughter something else other than a birth control pill to help them. I mean, these girls like literally are disabled. They can't walk. They're on their period. They're curled up in bed. They're throwing up. They're passing out. I'm sorry. Nausea, vomiting, throwing up during your period, passing out during your period, having pain where you can't get out of bed. All of that is not normal. You cannot tell a teenager that, oh yeah, by the way, suck it up. You're a woman now, you know? Welcome to womanhood.
That's terrible.
Not the curse. You were just one of the unlucky ones that got the bad period.
But also that speaks to like parental intuition, those moms just like not stopping, right? And we talk about that a lot.
How many more moms are there that don't have that?
We talk about that a lot.
All of my chronic pain patients that are now in debilitating pain, like the nerves have now like been wired to be in chronic pain because when you're a teen, your nerves are being wired. So now these patients who are untreated as teens are now in their 20s and now disabled forever. It's very hard to reverse it once their nerves have kind of settled into this feeling of pain, even if you remove the endometriosis later. This is not something that is normal. And those teenagers, if we can catch them early, treat it early, mm-hmm. maybe we can prevent them from becoming the infertility patient or the chronic pain patient.
Right. Well, and I think it's such a women supporting women, because like, listen, this is going to be the time where we bring up our friend Maeve, because we do this every single episode, but we're in a group chat because we all had our babies around the same time. And I think if, you know, she had a situation, and I think if Amy and I weren't like, no, trust your gut, like go find somebody else. You're right. Like, don't stop until you get the answers that you need. I think if we as women do not come together to support other moms to follow their intuition, I think it just gets suppressed by doctors. And to, like, knowing that gynecologists know nothing about this makes it even more. Or they don't know some.
It's just, you know,
don't know enough.
There's a lot of misinformation. It's improving. Thankfully, now that women are talking more, but it's going to take time for this to become a standard thing. Like, I still don't understand why endometriosis surgery is not a specialty unto its own, just like cancer surgery is. Like, right. Why can a normal gynecologist go in and say, I can do endometriosis surgery, and they have
zero- because it's for women. Because it's for women. That's why. Because research is underfunded for women. Because it's a specialty. Because it's something that affects only women. Like, I'm just gonna. I know that's a generalization. I'm probably going to get, you know, ripped apart. But like, there is data around how underfunded women-specific, like,
absolutely
research
and I don't even get into how little insurance will pay for this kind of thing. But
right, you know, right,
very underpaid.
I want to talk. So this episode is going to come out in June, which is, I believe it's called Worldwide Infertility Awareness Month, or World Infertility Awareness Month.
Let's talk about infertility a little bit. Yes.
Let's talk about that. So, I mean, I did go through, now I'm like, do I have endometriosis? But I did have secondary, undiagnosed or unexplained secondary infertility. So I had my second kid through IVF. And speaking from experience, it's incredibly, incredibly isolating. It's incredibly painful and difficult to go through. And I was fortunate enough to have a kid while going through it already. You know, I can't imagine what it would be like if you didn't have any children and you were just trying to start a family. But it's incredibly isolating. It's hard. From your perspective, obviously you see so many patients who are struggling with infertility. How do you kind of support them? Like, what advice do you have? What's your like take, having seen the medical side of all of this?
Well, I just think that you need to ask questions. I mean, half of the patients I see every day have infertility, and half of the patients I operate on have infertility. And a lot of them are very upset, you know, if they've gone through 6, 8, 10 cycles of IVF, and then they get pregnant like 2 weeks after my surgery or a month after my surgery. And then they're like, why didn't anyone tell me? I'm like, I don't know. I don't know why anyone didn't tell you. And the problem is there are some patients with unexplained infertility that have silent endometriosis, meaning they don't have any of the symptoms. So to me, again, I grew up in Canada. I'm a Canadian. All of the training I'm talking about I had was mostly in Canada. And in Canada, the way we treated infertility patients is we had to diagnose the cause before we would assign the treatment, right? Here, it seems like, oh, you have infertility, IVF. There's no like, oh, well, what's causing it? So in Canada, everyone who has infertility would have a hysteroscopy, would have a diagnostic laparoscopy to make sure they don't have endometriosis, would look at their tubes, would look at their, you know, their overall health, all sorts of things, their thyroid. Like, here I feel like a lot of that is missed. Like, we don't mm-hmm. diagnose it. Same with when you travel to Europe, and a lot of patients there. That's why endometriosis is actually way better treated in other countries than here, because the women with infertility are actually diagnosed because they all get laparoscopies. But to me, I wouldn't start going through infertility treatment until I found out what was causing my infertility.
Are you just like full of rage all the time walking around, just being like, every single day I see these patients that I have to, that are like walking with canes and crying and throwing up and can't have kids and they're depressed and all these things. And if only, like, for example, I know I'm simplifying it, but if only like one or two specific diagnostic tests were run, their entire lives could have been changed.
Yes. I mean,
how are you not full of rage?
That frustrates me. Honestly, I mean, when I have a day where I'm full of like new patients, like some days I have like 10, 12, 13 new patients and they're all the same like horrible aching story. I go home emotionally drained. I'm just like, oh my God, my heart is breaking for these women. But I also have hope because I know I can help them. I've slowly started converting the fertility doctors in San Francisco. A lot of them send me patients, you know, ahead of time. So, you know, I remember when I first came, like when I would talk to some of the fertility doctors, it'd be like, oh, endometriosis, you can't really treat that. You just have to do IVF, and then that'll take care of it. Surgery doesn't make a difference. And then when my patients started getting pregnant after I did surgery on them, then we're like, oh, okay, maybe there is something. And obviously it is surgeon dependent, right? Like if you do a bad endometriosis surgery, you can actually make someone's fertility worse, right? You can actually harm them. But if you do it properly, you can make it better.
That is definitely a prevalent misconception about endometriosis, because I know a little bit about it, but my understanding of it was basically like it's a condition that you just sort of have to live with. Like even if you get diagnosed with it, there's not a treatment, or you can't cure it. There's not a treatment. You can, you know, address symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. So even if you get past step one, which is like looking for it and finding out if you have it or not, then like the next step is like the misconception or misbelief that you can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And you can.
That's definitely
in a lot of cases.
But let's just clarify, even just getting diagnosed is very validating to women.
Yeah.
Like I have so many women that cry when I tell them they have endometriosis, because now they think they're not crazy, because they were told their whole life that, you know, that they're just sensitive. I hate that
they've
one. You're just too sensitive.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
You're just too tense. That's why it hurts when you have sex, or you're just too, you know, whatever. And just to tell them they have something wrong, and that's why they're having pain, or that's why they're having, you know, a lot of patients with chronic fatigue, you know, they're like, they just don't have the energy, and you do the surgery and now their energy is back. And they're like, oh my God, I didn't know I could feel like this. I feel like a new woman. I didn't know that I could live my life not dragging every single day, not dragging myself out of bed just to function. And it's like, it's very validating when you tell them, yes, there is something wrong with them. And then that there is a treatment available. So I think even just getting diagnosed is validating. And I think a lot of times, you know, I think there's a lot of gynecologists that they think about endometriosis, a patient comes in with a complaint, but they don't want to necessarily label it, because the whole, you know, diagnostic standard is you can't diagnose it unless you do the laparoscopy and confirm that it's there. But I always tell gynecologists, you know, just say that you might have it, like at least give them like something. Not mm-hmm. make them feel like they're crazy that they have all these symptoms or whatever, even if they don't. But I think the fear is if they say that, then it opens a whole can of worms. So what does this mean? Is it going to get worse? What do I need to do? Is it going to affect my fertility? Am I going to be able to have a baby? What does it look like? And you know, all of a sudden, you know, there's a huge long conversation that's happening that gynecologist wasn't prepared for. And so they would rather not, you know, give that label or give that diagnosis, because they don't really know how to handle all the questions that are going to subsequent to that. So yeah. I think that's part of it, right? Plus, I mean, if you realize most annual exams or whatever, or GYN visits at a doctor's office is what, a 10, 15 minute appointment?
15 minutes, you're being generous.
Gynecologists are vastly underpaid. We get what, $50 for a visit? We can't spend an hour doing it. Right. You know, doing a consultation because you have endometriosis. It's impossible to do that for a regular OBGYN. They just don't have the time. They can't do it. That's a whole, we haven't even gotten into the whole healthcare system and the whole healthcare system problems. And that's a whole another kind of norms. But at least getting diagnosis, don't underestimate how much of an impact it gives women, because at least it empowers them to be able to seek out treatment. I think for fertility patients also is validating. You know, a lot of women are walking around, why can't I get pregnant? They know internally there might be something wrong with them, or something wrong with their husband, or something wrong with the universe. And just saying, oh, you have to go through all these painful IVF treatments and blah, blah, blah. And then when they don't get pregnant, then they start seeking out the answers. Why are we not seeking out the answers from the beginning? I think even if the treatment is going to be IVF, at least you know what's causing it.
Right.
Right.
Right? Right. At least you know that there's something that potentially could be treated that can cause it.
Yeah.
I think women know intuitively there's something wrong, and they want to know the answers. They just don't know how to find it. And I think that's where these discussions and these forums and these podcasts are really helpful. And women talking to women. I mean, most of the patients that come see me, they're word of mouth. Friend tells
totally.
A friend.
Yeah.
A friend tells a friend. You know, or some Facebook group or something, they're talking about, oh, if you have a problem, go see Dr. Arati. She'll try to figure out what's wrong. So,
yeah. You know, I just met a woman, And she was dealing with infertility and she just gave up because the psychological toll was just way too much, you know. And it's, you know, I had just met her, but like it was so moving because she, you know, she started crying, which is, if you know me, this is normal.
Yeah.
People cry to Christina a lot.
People cry to me. I'm happy to be that person.
Me too. I have a lot of, I have tissues in all the rooms.
I should start just traveling with them.
Just put them in your pocket.
Yeah.
But it was heartbreaking because she wanted kids so badly that it's like if she had only known, right? And like could have not put and didn't have to go through all that psychological trauma to like even figure anything out, that she just kind of gave up, you know? So it makes me really happy to see how hopeful you are, because honestly, I just want to burn it all down. Like hearing you talk, I want to burn it all down. And you are just so innately positive about this that it's inspirational, honestly. And I want to just burn it down for you so that you can just keep doing all the work. And like, we'll just take it on. We'll just burn it all down for you.
Yeah. Let's save the women. Let's save all the women.
I mean, it's literally what I used to pray every night when I was 9, 10 years old to God to help me help women. You know, that was my mission. So I'm going to continue doing it till the day I die, probably. But
well, if anyone listening obviously is in California, you know where to go. But in terms of like, I don't know, what you wish people knew about, and let's talk about women. What you wish women knew about their bodies. You've kind of already said like, all these things that are not normal about having a period, like unknow that and learn a new way of seeing your period, which is that it should not be this like catastrophic monthly event.
Yeah.
I think. What else?
Periods should not be painful. You shouldn't have a week of PMS pain, whatever, the week before the period. You should not have pain with sex. All of that is not normal and completely treatable. There's no such thing as a small bladder. You have something wrong that can fix. Another one that kills me. So your periods are not supposed to get heavier when you get older, okay? So the abnormal bleeding that happens in perimenopause, a lot of that is polyps or hyperplasia or fibroids and totally treatable. And I see patients that come in and they're like bleeding to death during their periods. And they're like, oh, I thought I was just getting older. I'm like, what does that have to do with your periods? Actually, our periods get lighter when we get older, when we get perimenopausal. They're not supposed to get heavier. So that's one I hear a lot. And I wish people didn't. I don't know who's telling people that. Right. Your periods are not supposed to get heavier when you get older. There's something wrong if they're heavy. Heavy periods are not normal. You should not be wearing a tampon, a pad, and a period panty. No. Okay? That is not normal. You need to get that treated ASAP. Definitely postmenopausal bleeding is not normal. Absolutely not. That don't believe everything that a doctor tells you. If a doctor says, you know, X, Y, or Z is fine and no big deal, but it's a big deal to you, just change doctors, find someone else. And I talk that, like, even knowing for myself, you know, I got pregnant when I was later. I didn't get married till I was later. And I kept having pain with my pregnancy, really severe pain. And I kept telling my doctor, I think I'm having preterm labor. I think the baby's going to come early. And she just kept blowing me off. Oh, no, you have a cervix of steel. There's no way you're going to have your baby early. No big deal. I broke my water at like 33 weeks. And, you know, the baby almost died and all of this stuff. And I kept calling her and kept saying, listen, I'm having pain. And she just kept blaming. Oh, what did you think? Pregnancy wasn't going to hurt? I'm like,
well, are you kidding?
Yeah, no, really.
Does she know who you are?
No, yeah. It gets worse. After the baby was born, we were having such a hard time with breastfeeding and trying to feed the baby. I kept struggling for 6 months. I was like triple feeding, pumping, feeding him with a tube, like doing all this stuff and just like completely obsessed with how can I not figure out what's freaking wrong with this baby. I took him to the pediatrician 10 million times. I took him to like 6 lactation consultants. Oh, he's just lazy. He just doesn't want to eat. I'm like, there is no such thing.
A lazy baby.
A baby not wanting to eat. You know what it was? After like, you know, literally I didn't sleep for 6 months. I was literally obsessing and like trying to, I literally had to feed him every half hour because he couldn't eat. And finally I found out it was a tongue tie that was fixed in like 5 seconds with a pediatric dentist after I got onto a Facebook group with these women that were like, yeah, don't listen to your doctor. Don't listen to your
doctor. Oh my God.
And I felt like so bad. Like I failed my baby. Like I failed my child. because I kept like listening to these doctors that kept telling me that X, Y, or Z. I like, it makes me teary to this day. I struggle so much. And I'm a freaking doctor. Like,
yeah, you're like a genius doctor too. You're not like a subpar doctor.
Because I kept researching. I read like every article there was. I'm like, there has to be something. There has to be something. And when I found out what it was, I was like, what the hell?
Yeah.
How was this missed by like freaking 5 lactation consultants? And finally, I took him to a lactation consultant that was an expert in tongue tie. She looked at him in 5 seconds. She's like, yeah, he has a tongue tie.
Just get. And then let me guess, he started guzzling down breast milk like there's no tomorrow.
Of course, by then I had lost my milk supply. I had to take all these drugs and pump to try to get back. But I mean, it was such, it was like an instant fix. It's like, what the fuck? I'm sorry. What?
You can curse.
I was like, you know, how could you not tell me that if a baby's having trouble breastfeeding or whatever, that there's no such thing as a lazy baby? How can you tell a mom, oh, he just doesn't like breastfeeding? That makes me feel like he doesn't like me. Oh, my baby doesn't like me. He doesn't like my breast. He doesn't like my milk. There's such a lack of education, even amongst that. So, you know, after all this, I've become an expert in lactation too, because I know everything there is to know about breastfeeding because of the struggle I had with my child. But it's just like, I say this a lot to my patients, even if you don't like what I have to say, please go find another doctor that serves you. Do not sit there taking it. Do not accept for you not to be heard. If you think there's a problem, there's a problem. Listen, you have to listen to your internal gut. You listen. Women have great intuition.
Yes,
women have amazing intuition. And if we think something's wrong, something's wrong. And just because someone tells you there's nothing wrong doesn't mean there's nothing wrong. And you know, that one of the things I always say is women have to insist on being heard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I think there's something wrong, there's something wrong. If you're not listening to me, I'm going to go find someone else. Now, you may not like what I tell you, I think, is a treatment. And a lot of women don't agree necessarily with what I recommend for them. But that's their prerogative. You know, that's their choice. It's their body. All I can do is do my best for you. And that's all I can do.
But then the education side of things is where it's so important. And I don't mean like, I mean, the education you are doing is important formally and within a professional network and speaking and all of these things, but also just conversations that women are having with each other about their own experiences. Because I think that's part of why we started What I Wish I Knew in the first place, was because it felt like Christina and I were the only ones talking to each other about this weird shit that was happening that felt like it wasn't normal, whether it was with our babies or ourselves or our partners. And it was like, why aren't people talking about this? It must just be us. And again, over and over, it's not just us. It's never just us. But people aren't talking about these things. And so it just stays, we just suffer, or our kids suffer, or our partners suffer. And it is infuriating, but the education side of this, having conversations like this, or, you know, women empowering other women to ask for a second opinion. Like, I feel like it's even hard for a mom to be like, yeah, I think something's wrong, but like my pediatrician, I really trust them. They know more than me. Like, I don't know. I don't really want to hurt their feelings and go to someone else. I don't want to.
Is hurting someone's feelings. You're not going to hurt my feelings if you see me and you don't like, you want to go get another opinion. You're not going to hurt my feelings. I'm just trying to help people. I do my best. If I can't help you, I would love for you to find someone else that can help you.
Yeah,
like, that's how I feel as a doctor, and I think most doctors should feel that way. You know,
we should also not care what doctors think personally. Yeah, and that's not to offend you, but that's just to be like,
no, I agree. No, we shouldn't. You know, I wish I had found another pediatrician for my kid instead of struggling for 6 months, dropping like milk in his mouth one drop at a time with a little tiny syringe. Like, come on,
that's not normal.
Not normal.
No,
like, hello, it's a red flag. It's a red flag. How can our listeners like find you, support your work as, you know, potential patients versus in the professional network? Because I know it's probably different.
Finding me is easy. Go on my website, www.drmonaorati.care. You can message me through there. I do read all the emails, believe it or not. You can make an appointment online. You can call my office. Please be patient. I do have a long waiting list. Okay. You're not going to get in next week, but I will try to help you.
You're in San Francisco.
Right now I'm in San Francisco. We are actually moving to Walnut Creek probably in the summer. I'm not sure when yet, but definitely by the fall we'll be in Walnut Creek. By the way, I also do telehealth. I mean, I don't want to say that I only see patients in California. I see patients from all over the world. So,
okay, that's good to know. Because I was going to ask, in terms of people who aren't local to California, do you have like a referral network? Like, how do you handle it if someone is out of network or not out of network?
I work with gynecologists in other places, but honestly, if someone needs surgery, then they need to come in to California and, you know, and I'll do the surgery for them. And most of the time they'll come, I do the surgery and then they leave. Mm-hmm. If they're from out of the country, usually I have them stay 2 weeks. If they're from out of state, they usually come for a week for the surgery and then go back.
Got it.
So I mean, I have patients flying in almost every day, so it's not, you know, it's not an unusual thing.
If there's ever any way that we can utilize our platform to lift and spread your message, please let us know.
I mean, I definitely think we should talk again. I love meeting you. I love how passionate you guys are. I think we're very like-minded.
Yeah.
We should definitely meet and talk about all sorts of things. I have so many things I want to do and I just don't have the time. So my time is very
Well, thank you for giving us this hour. That means a lot, especially knowing all the things that you're doing, the people you're supporting, your own life, by the way, which we haven't even touched on, but,
I have a very supportive husband who does.
He sounds awesome.
Yeah. He also believes in what I do. So that's why he really he feels like his way of helping me is, you know, by helping me do what I do. Because he really believes in what I do. I mean, he'll sometimes come from the airport, and he'll be like, yeah, I talked to the Uber driver. Her daughter is really struggling. I need her to see you. He's just he literally talks to people about, you need to see my wife. She'll help you.
I love that. You said you have two kids. Is that right?
I have two boys.
I was going to say, if you have girls, like
a 2-year-old, I would love to have a girl. I don't know if it's too late yet, but I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Well, on behalf of our daughters, thank you for what you're doing for women on behalf of us and every woman that we know. I mean, it's incredible, your story and what you're doing. So, we just hope that this podcast is one step in spreading more education and definitely we should have more conversations in the future.
Yeah, we should.
If you found something helpful, insightful, or just plain reassuring in this episode, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next one. And if you have a moment, leaving a quick review helps more parents find us.
We're also always looking for great guests, so if you know someone or that someone is you, please reach out. You can find us at whatiwishiknew_ or whatiwishiknew.life.
Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay sane, stay calm, or at least fake it until bedtime.